It's time for security now. Steve's here. We got lots to talk about. It's a question and answer episode. And for the first time ever, with no questions and no answers, we actually run out of time before we get to questions. Maybe next week. Don't be fooled by the title of the show. We have lots to talk about, though. So let's get to it. Security Now is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now, episode 589, recorded Tuesday, December 6th, 2016. Your questions, Steve's answers, number 244. Security Now is brought to you by IT Pro TV, an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account, go to itpro.tv/securitynow and use the code SN30. And now through December 31st, 2016, if you purchase a premium annual membership, you'll get an additional 3 months added to your first year. And by Pearl Auto. Pearl makes Rear Vision, a set of wireless backup cameras for your car that fit around your license plate and sync with your smartphone. To get $50 off your Rear Vision, go to pearlauto.com/securitynow. And by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century with a fast, easy, and completely online process. Check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/securitynow. It's time for Security Now, the show where we protect you, your loved ones, your privacy, online with the king of security, Mr. Steve Gibson. He is here once again to bless us with his wisdom and knowledge. Hello, Steve.
With the Vulcan hand sign, your thumb's supposed to be in, right, with the other fingers?
So you're asking the wrong guy. Okay. Yeah, I think in.
Yeah. I think in. Yeah, out seems wrong. Anyway, so.
And which hand? Well, you do yours with the left.
I'm left-handed. So
I'm left-handed. Yeah, I can't really do it with my left. I practice with my right, I guess.
The best man in my wedding was unable to do it, so he had some little rubber bands.
Oh, that's funny.
That were like holding his fingers in two sets, because I said, Gary, please do not embarrass me, because, well, I mean, there's never been anyone in the world more capable of embarrassing someone.
But wait a minute now. This is a revelation, because are you saying everyone at your wedding party had to do the Vulcan live long and prosper gesture?
No, he got up for the best man speech, and he said, Steve has asked me, please, not to embarrass him terminally, so all I will say is, and then he held up his hand, and there was two little red, like little orthodontic rubber bands. He said, live long and prosper.
Oh, what a great toast.
That was perfect for me. Yes.
Great toast.
So last week was Q&A 243, and there was so much going on that we hit our two-hour podcast time limit after five questions. And those were the easy questions that I sort of put first so we could just get through them. So I thought, okay, let's try again. Q&A number 244, except that we've got Android meets Gooligan, Windows upgrades, bypass BitLocker, nearly a million UK routers taken down by a variant of the Mirai worm/botnet. The popular AirDroid app is seriously doing it wrong.
Yikes.
Researchers have invented a clever credit card disclosure hack. Cloudflare reports a new emerging botnet threat that they've been tracking.
Oh, boy.
Deliberate backdoors were discovered in 80 different models of Sony's higher-end IP cameras.
No.
We get some closure on our San Francisco Muni hacker.
Oh, good.
And I heard you at the end of MacBreak Weekly noting this fun hack where the Amazon Echo and the Google Home were talking to each other.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to mention that.
I'll play
there
it.
Is an interesting USB port killing dongle which has surfaced and is now commercially available that we need to talk about briefly. A caution about keyless entry, too easy to spoof fingerprint readers on some smartphones, an extremely troubling report comes from detectives or detectives' behavior in the UK. And finally, some good news, an open source covert USB hack defeating bit of software. We've got a bunch of fun miscellany, some science fiction reader slash listener book news, and not that there's going to be any time left, but we do have, I think I had 7 questions. I thought, well, we're never going to get to 10, so I'm not even going to pretend. But we've got 5 from last week that have spilled over, and I found 2 others just so we wouldn't run out. We're not going to run out. So, yes, I think another great news-packed podcast for our listeners.
Nice. Week. I'm very excited, and we had such a good time with you when you came up here for our year-end twit, which will air on Christmas Day. And then for the Christmas party, you stuck around as long as you could.
Until Renee and I said, okay, we're done.
Yeah.
Take us back to the hotel.
Took you back in the Tesla.
And I got to buzz around in your lovely Tesla.
Yeah, that was fun.
With the doors that worked most of the time?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It's behaved very well ever since, but something about you guys just broke it. Anyway, hey, let's talk real quickly about our sponsor for this hour, IT Pro TV. These guys are great. Tim and Don created IT Pro TV. A little bit, I'm happy to say, in an homage to Tech TV and to what we do here at TWIT. They wanted to make something similar to TWIT, a streaming channel that had content not kind of like TWIT's, except focused on the IT professional. So if you're looking to perfect your skills, to improve your skills, to stay caught up with a very fast-moving category, IT Pro TV is a great solution. It's also great for people who want to become IT pros and get the certs. In fact, they really focus on getting you the certs. That's their background. They've got now 2,000 hours of content, multiple studios now, recording more content every week, up to 30 hours a week. You can stream courses live or on demand anywhere in the world from your Chromecast, from your Roku, your Amazon Fire TV. They've got a great Apple TV app now. Of course, on your PC or tablet, too. It's a chance for you to learn, to build your career, to get a career. Courses include Certified Information Systems Security Professional, CompTIA Security Plus. They've got all the security stuff in here because of security now. But you can also get your A-plus cert, your Project Plus cert. I love the Certified Ethical Hacker Training. They've got the V9 courses up right now. In fact, they're doing this week, I think, the Computer Hacking Forensic Investigator. What a great skill that would be. You'd have a job for life. Cybersecurity Analyst Plus, Red Hat Linux, Lean Six Sigma Green Belt. They brought in a new trainer who does Lean Six Sigma. She's great. She's wonderful. I'm really thrilled with what IT Pro TV does. They have everything you would want. A great course library with easy-to-understand courses and full transcripts of everything, so you can learn any topic on demand. They also have virtual machine labs, so you can learn quite quickly. Even if you don't have a Windows server, you can set up server and clients with no risk with any HTML5 browser. They also have the Transcend practice exam, so you can take the test before you take the test. They've got clients all over the world in every industry. In academia alone, Harvard, all of Harvard's IT department subscribes to IT Pro TV. MIT does, UCSD, Stanford. The premium annual membership includes the ability to download IT Pro TV content for offline viewing, which is nice. And you can get a special through the end of the year deal on that. So here's our call to action. Visit itpro.tv/security now. Find out all about itpro.tv. You can get a free 7-day trial, and you can get 30% off your account as well when you use the offer code SN30. And now through the end of the year, through December 31st, 2016, if you do get the annual membership, you're going to get an additional, which is, by the way, the most affordable way to do this, you're going to get an additional 3 months free for your first year. Now's the time. Now's the time. Build your career, learn, stay in touch with your business, and have fun doing it. With Don and Tim and their entire team, they are the best. ITPro.tv securitynow. Don't forget that offer code, SN30. We were out there in Gainesville for their grand opening. Talk about a party that went all night. It was a lot of fun.
And a lot of studio space, you said.
Five. And it, and by the way, their sets, they've got like, oh, I'm so jealous. We had a stairway. I always wanted the stairway because we had a stairway on the screensavers. Not only do they have a stairway, they have an elevator. The stairway goes nowhere, the elevator knows where, but it looks cool.
So, we had our picture of the week. I got a kick out of someone shot me a cartoon from the Always Wonderful XKCD, and this is his number 1758, which depicts a large window encrusted building in the background with a very large prominent lawn sign labeling the building Department of Astrophysics, under which it says it gives us their motto, the motto of the Department of Astrophysics. Yes, it reads, everybody has already had the idea, quote, maybe there's no dark matter. Gravity just works differently on large scales, unquote. It sounds good, but doesn't really fit the data. So just
Steve.
Know that before you pass the sign. Yeah. And, you know, my point is, or was, has been, still is, that this, you know, it's like the equation doesn't balance. And so you go, okay, there's just a big blob of dark matter that if we put that in, look, now the equality works. It's like, okay, but that's really a hack. So, you know, I have no opinion one way or the other. I just thought it was fun that somebody had come up with a theory of gravitation that didn't seem to have that problem. So, but speaking of problems, Gooligan, which I guess must be what happens when you take hooligan and Googleize it, you get Gooligan. I guess that's the derivation of this name. Checkpoint is in the news again. They've essentially reverse engineered a mystery, which I think they have pretty much figured out what's been going on, which is a campaign which has been taking advantage of users who make the mistake of loading things into their Android phones from third-party, non-Google Play sites. So that's the source of the problem. More, and it's estimated that more than – now I'm seeing 1 million – oh, I knew I saw two, because logs collected by Checkpoint researchers show that every day Gooligan installs at least 30,000 apps fraudulently, and I'll explain what that means, because it's installing them as a means of making money for the hackers, which is an interesting twist, which of course provides their motivation, on breached devices, or over 2 million apps since the campaign began. So it's 2 million apps, and they've tracked a compromise of as many as 1 million Google accounts. So the Checkpoint blog starts out saying, as a result of a lot of hard work done by our security research teams, we revealed today, and this was last week, a new and alarming malware campaign. The attack campaign, named Gooligan, breached the security of over 1 million Google accounts. The number continues to rise at an additional 13,000 breached devices each day. Our research exposes how the malware roots infected devices and steals authentication tokens that can then be used to access data from Google Play, Gmail, Google Photos, Google Docs, G Suite, Google Drive, and more. Gooligan is a new variant of the Android malware campaign found by, they say, our researchers, Checkpoint researchers, in the SnapP app last year. So this began, as these things so often do, as sort of an isolated instance, and then sometimes it's militarized or weaponized or commercialized. Checkpoint reached out to Google, the Google security team, immediately with information about the campaign. And they say our researchers are working closely with Google to investigate the source of the Gooligan. So what they found was traces of this Gooligan malware code in dozens, and I saw the number 86 as I was digging into this, of legitimate-looking apps on third-party Android app stores. These stores are an attractive alternative, as we know, to Google Play for those who are not security conscious, because many of the apps are free or offer free versions of paid apps. However, the security of these stores, as we know, and the apps they sell aren't always verified, or we might say are not verified. Gooligan-infected apps can also be installed using phishing scams, where it's not just users going to a third-party store or following a recommendation from a friend, go get this over here, but it could just be a phishing campaign that gets this thing into your phone. So the way this makes money is that once the malware is in your phone, it simulates app advertisements provided by legitimate ad networks, causing the apps to install on the victim's device. So you first install this covertly malicious Gooligan-infected app, and who knows what the backstory is there. I mean, there's 86 of them, so you have to sort of wonder if the Gooligan people aren't maybe paying for co-residents in these apps. Maybe they're creating themselves from scratch, but that seems a little less likely than, hey, we'll give you some money if you'll, put this little extra goodie in your app that's not going to go through the Google Play Store, which would allow Google to spot it and remove it. So once the phone is infested, it then downloads additional apps for which the Gooligan malware authors are paid by the ad network, by the legitimate ad network, when one of those apps are installed successfully. So this affects Android 4 devices, Jelly Bean and Kit Kat, and 5, Lollipop, which encompasses more than 3/4 of the market devices today. And the preponderance of them, about 57%, are located in Asia, with about 9% in Europe. So essentially, that's what's going on. Now, what's significant is that what Gooligan downloads after Gooligan gets into the phone, it sends data about the device to the campaigns, that is the Gooligan campaigns, command and control server. It then downloads a rootkit from the command and control server that takes advantage of multiple well-known but typically unpatched Android 4 and 5 exploits, including one named VRoot, and it's got the CVE designation starting with 2013. So it's 3 years old, and that doesn't matter. As we know, the older Android phones, or in some cases not so old phones that just aren't being maintained by their providers, won't be updated. And the other common one is one known as TowelRoot that has a CVE dated 2014. So in both cases, these exploits still plague many devices today because security patches that fix them may not be available for some versions of Android, or the patches were never installed by the user or never offered by the bandwidth provider. So if the rooting is successful, the attacker has full control of the device and can execute privileged commands remotely. So it's a full remote access takeover of this breathtaking number of Android devices. After achieving root, Gooligan downloads another new malicious module from the command and control server and installs it on the infected device. That module injects code into running Google Play and Google mobile services to mimic user behavior. So sort of like a little automation shim that allows Gooligan to avoid detection. And that's been seen historically on other mobile malware. That module allows Gooligan to steal a user's Gmail, email account, and authentication token information, install apps from Google Play, and rate them to raise their reputation. It gives all the apps 5-star ratings after it downloads them, and installs adware, which generates revenue. So, of course, the ad servers, which don't know whether an app using its service is malicious or not, sends Gooligan the names of the apps to download from Google Play. So the whole system sort of forms a self-sustaining ecosystem, which is catastrophically rooting and infecting vulnerable Android devices while generating revenue for the miscreants behind it and continuing to support itself. So unfortunately, it's, you know, and we've watched the evolution of this over time. You know, 10 years ago, several years into this podcast, we were sort of musing how, isn't it interesting that all the Outlook viruses that we were covering back then, you know, they never really seemed to do anything except just exist. But the moment we saw this pay to unlock your encrypted data crypto malware, suddenly it became clear, as we predicted on the podcast, we're going to be seeing a lot more of this. Because as soon as, you know, this goes from, oh, look, Ma, what I was able to do after school, to, oh, look at the size of my bank account, that really changes the equation. And so here again is a way of leveraging the internet advertising revenue system, and we've seen, you know, fraudulent clicks and so forth, performed by scripting and browsers and that. This now, of course, also your phone is hooked into a command and control server, and remember that the fact that it's obtaining fresh code means that allows them to dynamically vary what this sort of this ad hoc network of rooted devices will do. So there, you know, more than a million of them are currently doing this, but they can change that apparently at will. And, you know, it's not clear. I guess these phones are stranded. I don't know how Google ever really resolves this for people, except, you know, the phones die finally and they get newer ones, which hopefully have an additional 4 years worth of security learning under their belt. Wow. And, oh, this is a fun one. A BitLocker bypass on Windows 10 through Windows upgrades. The root of the problem is unattended upgrades on Windows 10 machines. Think about it. How can a locked machine protected by BitLocker, that is so that the system drive is, the whole drive is encrypted, how can it perform unattended upgrades? We know they do. People are annoyed by it all the time. The system has to have some means of decrypting the system drive without the user's explicit interaction, permission, and password. A hacker named Sammy Laiho discovered an issue in Microsoft's Windows 10 OS that allows attackers to gain access to BitLocker encrypted data. Some of the coverage has been unexpertly worded because they talk about BitLocker being disabled. Okay, well, we know you can't disable BitLocker. If the entire drive is encrypted, then what you actually have to go the other direction. You have to fully enable BitLocker, giving it whatever it needs, the master secret key, which then allows it to decrypt and encrypt individual sectors through some means. So Sammy posted on the WinFu blog essentially the highlights of his method. He wrote, "There's a small but crazy bug in the way the feature update, which was previously known as upgrade, is installed. The installation of a new build is done by reimaging the machine and the image installed by, as we know, a small version of Windows called Windows PE, the pre-installation environment. This has a feature for troubleshooting that allows you to press Shift F10 to get a command prompt. This allows for decrypted access to a BitLocker encrypted hard disk because during the upgrade, Microsoft necessarily has to be able to get that drive into a decrypted or unencrypted read-write state. So if Shift F10 is pressed at the appropriate time during an upgrade without administrator privileges, without the legitimate user present, requiring no authentication at all, a command prompt window is opened, which allows full and unrestricted access to the system's storage devices." Whoopsie. So this method works not when performing little incremental updates, but on a major release install. So, for example, it works if you went from the original Windows 10 release build and you were jumping to the November update 1511 or the anniversary update 1607. So, and of course, those are things that affect all users. It also currently works on any new Insider build, since, as we know, those are sort of incremental whole system movements. So it's that phase. It's the major release upgrade. Windows, while it's doing it, has and we presume it's managing the keys securely. What this implies, though, and this is what's always made me nervous about BitLocker, as opposed to, for example, TrueCrypt. For example, Windows couldn't do this. Windows 10 with a TrueCrypt encrypted drive could not do it because it would not have the keys. But since it's established the BitLocker drive, it has no doubt squirreled its own private copy of that master decryption key somewhere, hopefully using trusted platform module, doing something good to protect it. But the point is, it's there. And that automatically implies that if compelled to do so, Microsoft does have the ability to unlock a BitLocker drive. The fact that they're able to perform a substantial image update on a locked non-admin access drive shows us that it's possible for that to happen. So again, we assume that they have done a good job of protecting the keys, but they're there, which is not the case if you use a third-party whole drive encryption solution. So tip of the hat to Sammy for noting that. If we'd thought about it, it's obvious in retrospect, Windows has to have that ability to take the drive out of full lockdown encryption in order to make a major change to it without any intervention. And in the coverage of this, it's been suggested that companies should disallow switching the Windows Insider builds on for machines running Windows 10, as a partial mitigation, only because what that does is it makes those opportunities much less frequent. Every available insider build creates another vulnerable moment when someone could access it. And of course, if someone grabbed a machine that was set up to automatically install insider builds, like law enforcement, all they would have to do is wait for one to become available, and the machine would unlock it itself for them. And then he also says that companies may also want to disallow unattended upgrades, but not necessarily updates. Again, the little it's the major system upgrades that if you disabled that, then you prevent this from happening. So anyway, just a heads up. Again, it should have been obvious to us that Windows would have to have this capability. And it's sort of an interesting note too, that on a non-Windows derived whole drive encryption, they can't. It would always take the user to provide the key from outside the system in order to allow Windows to do what it wants to do. Wow, there's been a lot of IoT or router stuff. TalkTalk is a major European provider. They're, unfortunately, they're sort of in panic/denial mode, because what, for example, Deutsche Telekom is saying is that as many as 900,000 of its customers had lost their internet connection as a result of a recent attack, and this is last week. The BBC reported that thousands of TalkTalk and UK post office customers had their internet access cut off by another attack against routers, probably the same one. And a spokesman for the post office told the BBC that the problem began Sunday before last, and it affected somewhere on the order of 100,000 of its customers. Meanwhile, TalkTalk, that seems to be at the center of the storm, says that, quote, some of its customers, unquote, had been affected, and it was working on a fix. So it turns out this is all surrounding a modified form of the Mirai worm. And of course, we've been discussing variants of Mirai and are not surprised, because we know that the source code got published and that we were immediately going to see variants. So we are. Some researchers, and of course the problem is, we've also been talking about IoT devices being shielded by their routers, and how fortunately a router, especially with universal plug-and-play disabled, if the IoT device will still work with universal plug-and-play disabled to keep the device from mapping ports into it from the outside, that router provides protection. But there's no protection for the router itself. It's the device on the front line. It's the one with the public internet connection. So it's really important that those be locked down. Researchers have there's a TalkTalk uses a DSL D-Link router, and I also saw, I was sorry to see that a Zyxel router was also implicated in this. So it looks like there are a number of them that have some weakness. A researcher observed the worm infecting the router, then a while later coming back and stealing the router's SSID and password. And the article that I was digging into this through noted that wiggle.net, spelled WIGLE.net, it's a site I had not encountered before, WIGLE.net, that is a search engine that aggregates and tracks networks. And for example, you can put an SSID into it, and it will tell you where it is. Now, we know that for example, Google has all that information. That's one of the things that they were collecting when they roam around the streets with their mapping software, picking up the SSIDs of routers. And years ago, we talked about how that strategy sometimes got confused if someone moved across the country and kept the router name the same. Suddenly, it would be a little confusing. And of course, SSIDs are not guaranteed to be unique, so you could have collisions, and I'm sure there are lots of them. But what that means, there is a bit of a problem here, because it means that malware that obtains your SSID and password can then use Wiggle, WIGLE.net, to essentially obtain your physical location from an IP address and probably disambiguate SSID collisions based on the IP, because it'll certainly have your IP address too, your public IP. So it could easily get some sense for whether, you know, what country you're in and maybe even what region you're in, because we know that IP mapping is getting a lot better over time. Wow. There's a very popular tool. Estimated it's been installed in about 50 million Android devices, known as AirDroid. It's a remote Android management tool. And unfortunately, this is our doing it wrong story of the week.
You know, it's so funny because I use AirDroid and we've recommended it for years. So now I'm worried.
Well, okay, so here's the problem. No authentication and weak encryption. If you don't authenticate,
well. That's all.
Right. So as I said here in my show notes, unfortunately, its communications protocol only uses rather weak encryption. Get this, one round of DES and no authentication. And we know what that means. Without strong authentication, encryption is unable to guarantee any privacy whatsoever. AirDroid's communications are encrypted with DES. Now, that's, of course, the data encryption standard from the Stone Age. But here's the first problem. They use ECB mode. Well, that's electronic code book, which is a fancy name for no chaining. That is, and DES is a 64-bit block. So that's one of the many problems. As we've discussed, 64 bits no longer provides enough security margin, which is why all new ciphers are 128 or 256 bits at a time. The idea being that you put that set of bits in and a different set of the same number come out. But with 64 bits, that just not enough scrambling is possible. The point of electronic codebook is that there are tremendous benefits from, as we call it, cipher block chaining, CBC, of various sorts. Electronic codebook takes each block by itself with no inter-block dependency. It's the chaining of the successive blocks that prevents you from easily spotting patterns in the communications. So because the point is with electronic codebook, every time the same 64 bits is encrypted under the same key, you're going to get the same 64 bits out. So this doesn't hide any repeated use of plain text, whereas cipher block chaining is designed to do just that. Next up in bad news is the encryption key, which start off with is only 56 bits, because that's the DES encryption key size, is hard-coded in the app itself. Thus, it's known to any attacker. And oh, by the way, the key is numerals 890, then lowercase JKLMS. And that's 8 characters. And understand, of course, that, you know, it's like I had to do a double take, because that's the key. You know, we're used to cryptographic keys being these gnarly looking, you know, 256 bits converted to ASCII, and it's just this huge thing of gibberish. This is 890 JKLMS, and that's the entire key. And everybody knows it. So an attacker performing a man-in-the-middle attack and redirecting HTTP traffic to a malicious proxy can modify the response received from the phones/phone/VNC upgrade request, which is normally used by AirDroid to check for updates to its add-ons. That allows an attacker to inject their own update and remotely execute custom code on the target device. Now, here's the sad thing. This was found. Oh, and by the way, this was all from Zimperium, our friends that first discovered and brought us Stage Fright, which was really pretty frightening for quite a while. They found this on May 24th of this year. So, you know, late spring before the summertime. Disclosed that this, sent it to the AirDroid guys. On the 30th, 6 days later, they received an acknowledgement. Zimperium followed up on August 10th, on August 17th, on August 22nd, on August 28th, on September 6th. Finally, on September 7th, they got a reply about a new upcoming release. Yay! November 28th. You know, not quite 2 months later, AirDroid 4.0.0 is released. Still vulnerable. Whoops. 2 days later, November 30th, AirDroid 4.0.1 released. Still vulnerable. December 1st, full disclosure. So Zimperium did the right thing. They took a look inside this app to see what it was doing. They found that, you know, I'm sure that the authors had the best of intentions, but it's just, it's amateur league crypto. I mean, it's just, you would have to call this obfuscatory. I mean, it's not protecting anyone's privacy. It doesn't protect it from man-in-the-middle attacks. Anybody on the same network or who can position themselves to intercept the traffic can do so. Decrypt what's going there, change queries, change response data. The AirDroid app won't know any different. And, 50 million users are using it now. So for Leo, you and any of our listeners.
Well, I stopped using it a long time ago, but now I'm glad I did. Holy cow.
Wow. Yeah.
Well, it was basically a very cool way of accessing the data on your Android device from your computer and vice versa, you know, kind of communicating wirelessly.
Yes, and I would love to have that, for example, on my iOS devices, kind of thing.
Well, you kind of do. It combines AirDrop with Handoff. It has a little push bullet stuff in there too, but I had it. I didn't use it that much, so I just kind of took it off. But a lot of downloads. I mean, a lot of people use them.
Yeah. I don't think this was malicious or deliberate. It's just these guys just didn't care.
Ham-fisted.
Yeah, and it's hard to DES, really?
Yeah. Yeah, everybody knows that.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Let's take a break. I'm going to sip some coffee.
All right. I would love to talk about this. I guess it's kind of an IoT device. Not really, though. It's more like a IO car device. It's the Pearl Rear Vision. It's a set of wireless backup cameras for your car. And actually, you know, I have backup cameras on my car, my Tesla, of course. This is better. I kind of wish I had this. And the thing is, it's really easy to install. Tony did it because he didn't have backup cameras on his car. Because it goes in the license plate holder. You put this, this looks like a license plate frame. But notice there's not one but two cameras on it. And what I really like about it is it has two angles. You plug the car adapter to your Onbark diagnostic port, your OBD port. You mount your phone in the dashboard or vent, and you put the Pearl app on your Android or iOS phone. And now your phone on your dashboard can see what's behind you. You get two cameras, one wide angle and one normal. You get audio and visual alerts to the to your phone to let you know if there's obstacles in the way. And the wide-angle view is so cool. I mean, it's like fisheye, so you could practically see around corners. You could see, you, if you know, I always or often park parallel in between, you know, everybody in Petaluma owns pickup trucks. These big trucks or SUVs, and I'm backing out blind. I cannot see. I can only see what's directly behind me, not what's coming. Well, this will let you see what's coming. It sees around corners, basically. Night vision too, so it works day or night. And I love this, the frame is solar powered, so it stays charged on its own. Bluetooth to sync the camera to your phone. The Pearl app automatically updates. It's, we need a new name for IoT in a car, the Internet of Car Things. But because it automatically updates, that's good to know, right? Your security is kind of protected. Tony installed it in 10 minutes. I got in the car. I mean, I couldn't believe it. It was so much better even than when I had the Audi. It's incredibly useful. The magnetic vent mount that you get for your phone goes right in the, you know, it's a pivot ball joint that goes right in the vent of your car, you know, your cooling system. So it's easy to put the, you don't, you know, the phone mounted in your view. If you can install a license plate frame, you can upgrade your car. If you're listening, we got a $50 deal right now. $50 off your rear vision from Pearl Auto. Go to pearlauto.com/security now. pearlauto.com/security now. I really love the phone mount too, because then it you don't have to, you know, glue something to your dashboard or anything. It just, I mean, they have that kind of dash mount, but the vent mount is so awesome. It goes right in the vent and it holds it beautifully.
I think it's very cool that it does it does solar recharging, yeah, too. Because I was thinking, do you hook it into your
no wiring
trunk lighting or something?
No, yeah, wiring.
That's clever.
And you and the OBD2 port means, you know, that's where the Bluetooth thing. I mean, it just couldn't be easier. And the view you get really is remarkable. It really. Frankly, I think this should be kind of required equipment on all cars. If you have an older car, this is the way to do it. pearlauto.com/security now. And, you know, even the Tesla doesn't have a wide angle and normal angle camera behind me. I wish it did. pearlauto.com/security now, and you'll save $50.
Yeah, they had not invented cameras when I bought
I know.
My car.
So. I know.
As you know, I rented that little Ford Fusion, which I drove around when I was up at Twit. And it had a rear view camera, and it was very nice.
I literally cannot drive without a rear view camera now. I mean, it's just, it's a huge thing. You know, backing out of anything, you can see exactly where you are. The sensors go beep, beep as you get closer. It's really nice.
So, this is so clever. This is one of these where it's sort of always been there and it never occurred to us. And that is, a group of security researchers have figured out how to crack the unknown information on any credit card. So to back up a little bit, we know, I mean, certainly I know because I wrote my own e-commerce system. I ask users for the set of possible information, their name, the 16-digit card number, 12 in some cases, I guess, the card expiration date, the CVV, the card verification value, and their street address, and BAT and zip code. And all of that information, except the cardholder name, that's never part of the verification, but the credit card number, expiration date, CVV, and the digits from the street and the zip code or postal code, those are all sent through an API that I've established with the merchant, the credit card merchant, to verify this information. Now, of course, I do all of that. And I was careful not to tell a visitor, a purchaser of SpinRight, what's wrong, because I want to protect everyone's security. So I just, and it's a, you know, it'd be easier if I said, oh, you know, you got the zip code wrong. But that also obviously creates an information leakage, which I explicitly avoided. So I just say, sorry, try again. Something was wrong. I know exactly what's wrong because I get error status information back from the credit card processing merchant. But I don't share that with someone on the site because they might be trying to abuse the security and the protections. The bad news is not all sites that process credit cards check everything. There are some that only do the absolute minimum, which is the credit card number, known as the PAN, the PAN, the primary account number, and the expiration date. Those two things are the absolute minimum, and it's all that some sites do. Some do three fields. They'll do the PAN, the expiration date, and that CVV, that verification number, the three digits. Sometimes it's four printed on the back, but that is explicitly not in the magstripe. The idea being that it's not possible for anyone who electronically reads the card to determine what was printed on the outside. And then you may have the full Monty, which is what GRC does, which is the credit card number, expiration date, CVV, and both numeric portions of the physical address, the street number and the postal code. So what these guys very cleverly realized was by identifying what things a huge number of e-commerce enabled sites on the internet check, they are able to step through and determine all of the fields. So, for example, there are only 60 possible expiration dates because cards are only issued with expirations a limited time in the future, and expiration dates are only granular to the month, 12/2016, for example. So they go to they've identified a large number of sites which only check two fields. So they just guess. They put in the credit card number they want to crack, and they try expiration dates from, I don't know if they did it from now to further out or start in the middle and go both directions. There's probably one strategy that would tend to work more than another. But the point is there's only 60 possible expiration dates. So they're going to get a success eventually on one of those sites. But they may not want to buy any squirrels today. So, the squirrel e-commerce site is not where they want to perpetrate their fraud. But that squirrel e-commerce site, just – I don't know why I chose the word squirrel. That's the term I really want to use. Yeah. Don't pay any attention to the squirrel logo.
No squirrels.
On my microphone.
Nope.
So a squirrely site. Anyway, so now they have the expiration date that matches the credit card as approved by the back-end verifier. They cancel the purchase, instead of following through with it. Or maybe they buy something for $1, but basically that allows them to take that first step. Now they go to a site that checks the credit card number, the expiration date, which they have both of now, and the CVV. Well, that's three digits. So there's only 1,000 of those. Lots of e-commerce sites. And so they, again, guess until they get it right. Now they're down to the address. And it's a little trickier there. First of all, it should be noted that most sites don't incorporate address. That is just the three fields, the the credit card number, the expiration date, and the CVV, they're regarded as, well, how could a bad guy know that? That's got to be secure enough. So it's very likely that, that's all they need then in order to essentially reverse engineer the information. So the weakness comes from the fact that the back-end verifier is not smarter, that is not as smart as it could be. It turns out MasterCard processing is. It will notice 10 global attempts and failures on the same card and lock it down. Visa, the largest processor, credit card network in the world, does have no similar protections. So MasterCard will tend to thwart this, because if you've got, to guess 60 expirations plus 1,000, well, I guess expirations maybe half that on average, so 30, and maybe 500 CVVs, still, now you're at 530 and on average guessing, and MasterCard locks you out after 10. So you cannot attack MasterCard that way, but you can attack Visa that way. I just thought this was very clever. I mean, it's just been, again, one of these things that's been sitting here in the open that nobody really thought about is that, you know, for example, and for example, GRC also, as I've mentioned before, puts a strict limit on the number of anything that happens on our e-commerce system. That is, I have a counter and I count up, and as soon as that thing hits a maximum, I say, I'm sorry. I mean, for any reason at all, because you can't have any exceptions, I just say, you know, whatever you're doing is not in compliance with the policies of this site. Would love to sell you a copy of SpinRite, but apparently that's not going to happen. Many sites do perform a lockout like this, but there are others that don't. And even those that do, that are not testing everything, can still be abused. So this proof of concept software that these guys developed uses a site until it locks them out, and then they go somewhere else. And again, there's you know, tens of thousands of them on the internet, all no coordination among them, except that for the central clearinghouse, MasterCard got it right. For whatever reason, Visa decided not to do that. So, these guys noted that once you get enough information, you can then transfer money through Western Union to Russia or wherever, and that money is gone. Now, of course, Visa indemnifies its card holders for that kind of fraud. So you just say, hey, I didn't buy this, and they remove the charge from your statement. At some point, if this continues to escalate, this gets expensive for Visa, and I imagine they'll think about creating a better lockout system. Very cool hack, though. Just, I thought that was so clever. Cloudflare has been noting signs of a growing Mirai rivaling DDoS botnet being formed. They've been watching traffic and spotting patterns. On November 3rd, this began, the day before Thanksgiving, when they encountered an 8.5 hour, 172 million packet per second attack, delivering 400 gigabytes, gigabits per second.
Yikes.
Yeah. The following day, it repeated, though it started 30 minutes earlier. On the third day, the same start time, but it ended a bit earlier, typically around 8 hours. After getting up to 200 million packets per second and 480 gigabits per second sustained for 8 hours. And this continued day after day through Black Friday, Cyber Monday, and into this week, with traffic peaks up to 400 gigabits per second for hours on end. And a week ago, last Tuesday, the attacks stopped taking 16-hour breaks, they're now running 24 hours a day. Ooh. So, but Cloudflare knows they are not coming from the Mirai botnet, because we know what the Mirai botnet does. They're using different attack software and sending very large layer 3 and layer 4 floods aimed at TCP. So that's old school DDoS style or DOS style attacks. You know, layer 7 is the so-called application layer, and that's what we know Mirai was using. It was using non-spoofed HTTP and HTTPS connections. That's layer 7. Layer 1 is the physical layer, that is the actual definition of the wires and the voltages on the wires of, for example, Ethernet. Layer 2 is the data link, which describes what the waveforms are on those wires and how data is represented. Layer 3 is the network layer, which is the first emergence then of aggregated bytes to form packets. Then layer 4 is the transport layer, where you've got IP headers and protocol designations and so forth. This was all really well architected in the beginning. It's called the OSI network model, layers 1 through 7. And so these bots running in layers 3 and 4 are not bothering with establishing TCP connections and running anything over the TCP protocol the way Mirai has been. They're doing down at transport and network layer. So a lower level attack, but wow, sizable. And I have a feeling we'll be hearing more about that in the future. Okay, Sony. A group called SEC Consult security researchers performed a static analysis of a single Sony IP camera's firmware. So, and as we know, this is a sort of the contemporary, a very valuable means of determining what's going on. We know, for example, many of the backdoors have been found in routers because the firmware is freely available. A researcher, or unfortunately a hacker, a malicious hacker, gets the code. It's typically compressed. They decompress it and they stick it into a disassembler to perform the first stage of reverse engineering that turns the binary machine language into its assembly language, more readable ASCII form. And then they just go browsing around in there. So these guys did that with the firmware for a Sony IP camera. What they discovered was unfortunate. The good news is Sony has offered updates. The bad news is this was deliberate, clearly intentional, and a secret hidden backdoor that Sony had in 80 different models. The series X, C, H, and W, which encompasses mini domes, fixed cameras, and PZTs, pan, tilt, and zoom cameras. So not low-end baby monitors, but commercial-grade, high-end cameras. What was found by looking at the firmware were two built-in username password pairs, the username debug and the password Popeye connection, and the password Primana, P-R-I-M-A-N-A, as both the username and password. That would, if that was put into a query to the camera's web interface, it would recognize those and bring up a Telnet SSH server that then allowed you to Telnet and SSH in. They found the passwords, they found the hashes for the passwords for those, but for the sake of security, have not disclosed the reverse of those hashes. They did, however, publish the hashes. So this is the Sony IPELA engine IP cameras, which they wrote contain multiple backdoors, which, among other functionality, allow an attacker to enable the Telnet SSH service for remote administration over the network. And there was like a whole command decode list that they showed. One of them, the one that stuck out, was where it says Telnet. So you issue the Telnet command and it launches the Telnet process, opens the Telnet port 23, and you're able to log into the camera remotely. So there's other available functionality that they say that may have undesired effects, sort of more of a hackish nature to the camera's image quality or other camera functionality. And after enabling the Telnet SSH, another backdoor allows an attacker to gain access to a Linux shell with root privileges in the camera. So again, in the notes, I've already got the show notes, by the way. I posted it, the note on Twitter, but they are already online because there's a bunch of links here people are going to want, especially when we get to the amazing Humble Bundle of O'Reilly.
I already bought it. You're going to mention that?
E-books.
Yeah.
Yep.
That was a good deal.
and it expires tomorrow night.
Yeah,
so I want to make sure that our listeners know. So yeah, there's a bunch of links in the show notes there. So the show notes are already up. There's a link there, grc.com/security now. The top item is our most recent, this podcast, 589, and the first little link there, because there's only one right now until we get the transcripts back from Elaine, are the show notes. So anyway, Sony has said, okay, they said thanks to the developers, Sony did, and offers patches to close these remotely accessible Telnet and SSH root access on their 80 different cameras. So, wow. I don't know how we proceed. If we're going to have to go through a certification process, these are all you can get root on a Linux running in the camera. You've got an IoT attack bot. So that's bad. And these are not, cheapy cameras either. But you have to have the camera exposed or accessible either on a LAN or remotely from the WAN. So it's not as bad as if the camera went out of its way to create a public exposure for itself. Still, I'm glad we've got people who are looking at this. I mean, and these are lessons that all of these manufacturers have to learn. This is not okay. I don't know how. I mean, I just don't know if they'll suffer enough reputation damage to cause them to back out of this. And why have this? Like, why? It's going to get found. I think that's what manufacturers have to appreciate, is that, they can obscure this secret, but if it's in the firmware as it has to be, then bad guys can find it and abuse it. Now, there's some sweet justice in this one. We discussed the San Francisco Municipal Transport Authority system that got hacked over the over the Thanksgiving weekend, and how that more than 2,000 computers were infected by crypto malware. We did not know then whether Muni in San Fran paid the ransom, which I think was $73,000 in Bitcoin. The guy was asking.
That's what they were asking, yeah.
Or what happened? So here's, get this, a security researcher who requested anonymity correctly guessed the password recovery security question protecting the hacker's email account.
OMG.
So the email was cryptom27@yandex.com.
It's a big Russian ISP. In fact, it's like Yahoo for Russia.
Right. So a security researcher.
With equally good security, it sounds like.
Yes, yes. Guessed the guy's password recovery security question, reset the account's password, obtained access to the account's email history. Now, this, of course, we understand why he's asking to be anonymous. He then used Brian Krebs as his insulation so that Krebs would be reporting what this unnamed anonymous security researcher found. So now we know a lot more. On November 20th, hacked emails, that is the emails that were found in this guy's account, show that 64 bitcoins, about $45,000, were successfully extorted from a U.S.-based manufacturing firm. These guys know who, but they're not wanting egg on anyone's face, so it doesn't really matter. Brian noted in his reporting of what the security researcher provided him that the attacker appears to be in the habit of switching Bitcoin wallets randomly every few days or weeks, quote, for security reasons, unquote, the Muni hacker explained to some victims who took several days to decide whether to pay the ransom that had been demanded of them. So basically, this security researcher and then Brian are looking through the entire email history of this crypto malware hacker who's lost control of his email account and thus able to reverse engineer and piece the history together. A review of more than a dozen Bitcoin wallets, and that's why Brian notes the guy kept changing wallets around. And so what happened was this guy, people tried to pay the ransom to a wallet that was no longer current. And the guy had to say, oh, no. Now I've changed the wallet. Now you got to send the ransom over here. So a review of more than a dozen of this person's previous Bitcoin wallets, which this criminal has used since August, indicates he has successfully extorted at least, that is, they have evidence of $140,000 in Bitcoins from victim organizations. And that is almost certainly a conservative estimate of his overall earnings the past few months, Brian writes. He said, my source said he was unable to hack another Yandex inbox used by this attacker between August and October of 2016. And that was W88990165. Amazing that one wasn't taken. At Yandex.com. And that this email address is tied to many search results for tech help forum postings from people victimized by a strain of ransomware known as Mamba and HDD Decryptor, which of course we've spoken of on this podcast previously. According to a review of email messages from the Cryptom 27 accounts, which is the one that was obtained, shared by his source, writes Brian, the attacker routinely offered to help victims secure their systems from other hackers for a small number of additional bitcoins. In one case, a victim who had just forked over a 20 Bitcoin ransom. And by the way, Bitcoin's now up to $765, so that's a chunk of change, seemed all too eager to pay more for tips on how to plug the security holes that got him hacked. In return, the hacker pasted a link to a web server. Let's download some more software from the guy that just encrypted our company. Wow. And urged the victim to install a critical security patch for the company's Java applications. Wow. Quote, read this and install patch before you connect your server to internet again, the attacker wrote, linking to an advisory Oracle issued for a security note that it plugged in November of 2015. So an unapplied patch to Java that exposed a vulnerability that apparently was used. I don't know if that was how this guy got in, but sounds like it may have been. So, oh, we also know that for what it's worth, the SFMTA, the San Francisco Municipal Transport Authority, said it never considered paying the ransom. The list of victims indicates that the Transport Authority's decision was uncommon. The majority of organizations victimized by this attacker were manufacturing and construction firms. And it's interesting. I wonder if they're all using the same set of Java apps, you know, like some quoting, online quoting package or something. Who knows? Based in the United States, and most of those victims ended up paying the entire ransom demanded, generally one Bitcoin per encrypted server. An SFMTA spokesman, Paul Rose, said, quote, "We have an information technology team in place that can restore our systems, and that's what they're doing. Existing backup systems allowed us to get most affected computers up and running, and our information technology team anticipates having the remaining computers functional in 2 days." So, as we said when we talked about this, we were hoping that the MTA would easily resolve this from backups. And it looks like that's indeed what they are able to do and doing. And Leo, I thought this was interesting. It's Mac and iOS currently only. They say that a Win 10 beta is on the way. I don't know if any other down version for Windows support will ever be made available. But it's a company called Atlas Informatics. Their product is Atlas Recall. And I couldn't find an economic model behind it, which always makes me a little nervous. But it's atlas.co is the website. So this is something which indexes and captures everything you see as
I saw this and I was kind of tempted to try it. Yeah.
Yeah. I had you in mind. I thought, yeah, you know, it might be interesting to see what you think. So in their FAQ, they say that they describe it as a cloud-based store/index of everything you ever do on your computer. And of course I'm thinking, wow, maybe I could close some of those 200 tabs. They say, what is Atlas Recall? Atlas Recall is software that makes you smarter, okay, well, probably not, and more productive, well, maybe so, by giving you a searchable photographic memory of your entire digital life.
I really love this idea.
I know. It's a cool – I'm holding on to these tabs because it's like, oh, I may never get this again.
Right.
And and Firefox has a tab history, which I, you know, overwork, but – just imagine if you saw it, this thing grabbed it and sucked it up to the cloud and indexed it. So, oh, and it's cross-device so that they can't grab from iOS yet, but you can look up and view from your iOS devices. So
they
phone
look like
and
nice
tablet.
People.
Yeah, they're nice.
They don't look like the NSA. They're based in Seattle.
So, again, recognize the trade-off, but, you know, for somebody for whom this benefit makes sense, I could see it. So they say, how does Atlas Recall work? Recall runs in the background as you work, chat, play, and surf, making note of what is important to you. It remembers everything you see and interact with on your computer, then stores it in a secure cloud, enabling you to return to it from any device where you've installed Recall. They say, how is Atlas Recall different than searches like Google or Spotlight? They say Google, Spotlight, and Cortana do a great job at help. Huh? do a great job of helping you find content within a limited sphere. Google specializes in web searches, while Spotlight and Cortana help you find local files on your device. Atlas Recall makes the search services you use every day better, giving you the power to search for anything you see across your entire digital life with one search. Then two last questions. Once I find what I'm looking for, can I open the file? Yes. With Recall, you can search for any content you've seen on one device, then open it on the same device or any other one you have Recall installed on.
That's kind of cool.
It does. It sounds great.
Finally, the guy, Jordan Ritter, the guy who started this, was one of the Napster kids. I remember his name.
Finally, what types of content does Recall remember? Anything you see on your screen, Recall remembers. This includes web pages, social media, docs, apps, chats, and pretty much everything else. And if you prefer Recall to not remember any element, you're empowered to pause it or block it at any time. So you can say, you can turn on in I want to say insomnia. That's not what I mean. I've forgotten what the word is about forgetting.
Amnesia.
Amnesia. Thank you. Turn on the amnesia function. Oh, but you are also able to blacklist things.
Right.
So it has a blacklisting feature.
Don't index my porn, in other words.
Precise. Oh, yeah, exactly.
Don't index my porn feature. He was a hacker. I'm reading his bio on Wikipedia. And he worked in the computer security industry for an Israeli company called Netect, and then Hacker Shield. So he's actually got an interesting pedigree. And he met Sean Fanning in '99, and he was at Woo Woo, which was a great hacking company. You remember Woo Woo? Oh, Woo Woo was great.
Yeah.
Like, I might know Jordan. I might have met him in the Woo Woo days because I knew the name was familiar. And he worked on Napster. He lived with Fanning and Sean Parker at the San Mateo Marriott Residence Inn to create Napster. Anyway, he's got a good pedigree. I don't think he'd be working for the NSA. That would be the thing that would worry me, right?
I mean, so, you know, understand that you are basically, it's like, you know, a camera is looking over your shoulder 24/7 and snapshotting everything that happens and sending it off to the cloud. I presume from the browser they're grabbing the URL and then they're independently retrieving the page and indexing it and storing it and so forth. But they're indexing it, making it searchable. So yes, certainly there is a privacy trade-off. But if for the kind of content you use and your lifestyle, if having that kind of access seems worth it. Unfortunately, it's currently Apple only, but they did say they're working on a Windows 10 solution. And you can sign up for a mailing list. They'll notify you as soon as the Win 10 system is available. So that seems interesting.
Yeah. He's also contributed a lot to open source. So I think this guy's okay.
Yeah, it feels right.
Yeah.
Okay. this is just a freebie. A guy cleverly figured out how to get the Amazon Dot or the Amazon Echo Dot and the Google Home.
Oh yeah.
To have a never-ending conversation. And it's sort of obvious but kind of fun. I just wanted to make sure
I'm just mad that I didn't think of it.
Yeah, it's clever.
Should I play it? I mean, it's very short because it's actually an infinite conversation.
Yeah,
but he only plays I'll only play a little bit of it. So they're sitting next to each other, and he starts it.
Alexa, what's on my calendar tonight?
He says, "What's on my calendar tonight?"
Tonight there is one event at 6 p.m. There's Hey Google, what's on my calendar? Okay,
you can hardly hear it, huh?
You have a calendar entry today at 6 p.m. The title is Alexa, what's on my calendar tonight? Tonight, there is one event. At 6 p.m., there's Hey Google, what's on my calendar tonight?
You get the idea.
You have a calendar entry today at 6 p.m.
So I could do this because I have a Google tonight. home sitting right next to my Amazon Echo in my kitchen. So what you do is you create a calendar entry on your calendar that says, hey, Echo, what's on my calendar tonight? And you ask the Google Home for it. It plays it back, and the Echo wakes up, and it asks, I guess he must have two calendars.
Exactly.
Different calendars attached to each.
One calendar at each end.
Yeah.
Yep. Very clever.
It's funny.
Okay, so now this is a concern. It's called the USB killer. It's now widely available for $50. It started as a guy just sort of hacking. And unfortunately, it allows somebody who has it to, within a few seconds, to fry almost anything that has a USB port.
Nice.
It is effective on about 95% of the devices tested. So what it is, it looks like a thumb drive, very innocuous looking. And so you simply, if you are a bad guy with one of these, you plug it into somebody's USB port. You know, like that, I don't know, I don't want to suggest the seat back on the airplane that you're flying in, because that would not be nice. Certainly not the car you've rented, because they would know, you know, who you are. But, I mean, you don't want to do that. I'm not recommending anyone do this. But it, what it does is it's got a bank inside of high voltage capacitors and a high frequency inverter, which steps the 5 volts up to 220 volts. So it's, you know, we all remember the sound in the old days where you had photo flash strobes and they would flash, and then you would hear, which was a low voltage battery charging a high voltage capacitor, which would then be dumped across the photo tube to create a plasma that made a bright flash. In this case, after these bank of high voltage capacitors charge up to 220 volts, it dumps them onto the USB data lines and blasts with 220 volts whatever's connected. Now, the degree of damage is a function of how much integration there is. For example, if it was a motherboard that had a freestanding USB hub, then that hub would probably get taken out. But the rest of the computer would probably be fine. You know, you pretty much guarantee killing that one USB port, maybe all of the USB subsystem, depending. But on more highly integrated devices like smartphones, it either kills the USB interface or in some cases wipes out the phone. So again, the currently, probably mostly for the sake of minimizing cost, and also because it's not obviously necessary, there is no strong electrostatic protection, ESD, electrostatic discharge protection. And if you've ever looked at the USB plug, you'll notice that the outside, it's got four connectors. The outside fingers of the connector protrude further to the front of the connector compared to the inside pair. Well, that's deliberate. That brings up the power and ground as you plug it in just before it brings up the data, specifically to eliminate and minimize an electrostatic differential between the between the two devices, which are then about to get their data lines connected. So the designers of USB were clever. They said, okay, you know, we're just going to – we'll have the data fingers back further so that power and ground are established first. That brings the devices at opposite ends of the USB cable to the same ground potential. Then the data lines get met. As a consequence, there is no need for, until now, secondary zapping protection. And it's easy to add. I mean, you know, there's electrostatic protection devices exist. They're inexpensive, but again, if you don't need them, why have them in there? Well, now there's a USB killer that allows, you know, anybody who has access to a USB port to basically kill it in a few seconds. Not nice. News from the BBC in the UK that there is a rapid growth of keyless auto entry, or actually auto exit, theft. What's happening is that we've discussed at length the security implications of wireless entry, and we talked about all the technologies, you know, measuring time of flight in order to actually determine how far away the key was. We talked about hacks where people had their car keys in the house, but because the transmission was it's bidirectional, but the car depends upon the, I can't remember now which direction it was. If you amplified it in one direction, I think it's that the keys transmitter is not powerful enough to get to the car, but the car is powerful enough for the key to hear it. So if you amplify what the key sends and rebroadcast it to the car, you're able to access the car even though the key is a long way away when there isn't a round trip time technology in place. Being an old timer, I'm skeptical. My car actually does have you still stick it in a slot and twist it, but it does have the radio lock unlock. And I always make sure I hear the car clunk when I lock the doors. The takeaway from this is develop that habit if you don't have it, because what's happening is bad guys are lurking around with a broadband jammer, which prevents the car from receiving the lock signal if it is explicit from a driver's keys as they're walking away. They assume when they press lock that the car is locked. They walk away. The bad guys open the doors, rummage through the car, and steal things. And apparently it's happening more and more as this technology becomes more prevalent and as jammers become also more available. A quick note that it only takes 15 minutes, some researchers have found, to hack the fingerprint scanner on Samsung or Huawei smartphones. It turns out that they are susceptible to a simpler attack than we've talked about before, where you need essentially a 3D fingerprint clone in order to work. The Samsung and Huawei smartphone fingerprint readers will respond to conductive ink. So if someone can get someone's thumbprint or whichever finger they use to unlock their phone, do a little bit of photo touch-up and print that on conductive ink, either laser or inkjet, the Samsung and Huawei smartphones will say, "Oh, their owner is here," and unlock themselves. So not very difficult to do, and it's something that these guys nailed it to a process of about 15 minutes from start to finish. Okay, now, Leo, this is the troubling story of the week.
We mean the ones before weren't? Okay.
Oh, I know. It's been a bad week.
Oh, I'm so relieved. I know. Those weren't bad. This is the bad one.
This is really bad. UK police have taken to mugging suspects to obtain their unlocked phone.
They got to jump them, right?
Yes. I can't believe this is legal. I mean, that like the evidence you would obtain from what is technically a mugging wouldn't be fruit of the poison tree.
One would think.
Detectives, this was the BBC again, reported. Detectives have developed a new tactic to beat criminals using mobile phone encryption, legally mugging them. This emerged after Scotland Yard's cybercrime unit smashed a fake credit card fraud racket. Officers realized crucial evidence in the investigation was concealed on a subject's iPhone, but would be unobtainable if the device was locked. So A covert team seized it in the street while the subject was on a call, beating the security settings. The, quote, street seizure, unquote, of the phone was dreamt up by detectives of Operation Falcon, a specialist Metropolitan Police team running investigations into major fraud and related crimes organized online. The suspect, Gabriel Yu, had been under investigation for the suspected manufacture of fake cards that gangs were using across Europe to buy luxury goods. Detectives suspected that he was using an iPhone exclusively to communicate to other members of the network. But they knew if they arrested him, he could refuse to unlock it, and they would never see incriminating evidence. They considered whether they could legally force a suspect's finger or thumb onto the device's fingerprint reader to unlock it, but found they had no such power. However, they concluded they could stage their own, and here's the phrase I have trouble with, lawful street robbery, which I guess is not an oxymoron, using a similar snatch technique to a thief. And in June, so this was last summer, a team set out to do precisely that. Undercover surveillance officers trailed you and waited for him to unlock his phone to make a call, thereby disabling the encryption. I'm just gobsmacked.
Well, I presume they had so this is a little different. So they had a suspect in mind. I don't know how it works in the UK, but here you would have gotten a warrant.
Probable cause.
And if what one man's jumping is another man's, you know, swooping in at the appropriate moment. Right.
I think
that it's a little bit sensationalizing to say that they mugged the guy.
Yeah.
They're just trying to get the phone at the opportune moment.
They didn't beat him up. They just took it from him.
Right. Now, if they did it without a warrant, or they were walking down the street and they did it, but this sounds like, no, they were tailing this guy. They were undercover agents. They presumably, he was a person of interest. He was a suspect in a crime.
That also presumes then that a judge would have
approved
it. Yes, you may, if you believe you have reasonable cause.
It's analogous. You could say that if I have a warrant and come in your house and search it, that's breaking and entering. But it isn't, because you had a warrant and a judge approved it. So maybe this is a little sensationalistic on the part of the BBC.
So
I don't know. I don't know the circumstances.
For our listeners, just be aware that apparently that's happening now.
Yeah. In the UK. Yeah.
In the UK.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I have good news. Finally. Actual good news. For everybody who's been worried, and I just, you know, the hacker terms, who anyone who's been worried about their rubber duckies and land turtles, we have good news. A rubber ducky is the hacker term for a device, which a USB device, which performs keystroke injection attacks. And a land turtle is what we've been talking about just recently, last week. USB devices which register themselves as network adapters. Remember how problematical that is, because Windows and Mac both say, oh, a new LAN, and immediately query it for a DHCP information, which, if it's clever, allows essentially a complete compromise of the communications of the machine. So a neat developer has created something called Beam Gun, BEAMGUN, Beam Gun. I've got a Bitly link. I've got a GitHub link. It's on GitHub. It's open source. He's been working on it for a while. He changed the way it worked so that it uses the WMI, the Windows instrumentation framework, to work better. Management, Windows Management Infrastructure, is that WMI? I can't remember the acronym.
what it stands for. But so when a USB keyboard, it's a tiny program, runs in the background, listening for USB device insertion notifications. So it's able to read. So the WMI framework allows an app to register to be notified of these events and to take some action. When a USB keyboard device is plugged in, Beamgun blocks all keystrokes from that device until explicitly told to allow them. And when a USB LAN adapter is plugged in, it's disabled. So for any listeners who are concerned about this worrisome technology, if, for example, if you're a high-risk target for some reason, if you could be subjected to someone sticking a dongle into your laptop, this thing...
Not with what you just said about USB frying. Don't let anybody touch your laptop.
You really do want to just, as the developer said, fill them with epoxy.
Yeah.
Yikes. Yikes. So I have a couple bits of miscellany. Why don't we do take a break, and then I will do we will continue.
And I just wanted to briefly put a plug in. Baratunde Thurston tweeted me with this very interesting installation. It's in New York City. If you are in the city, you might want to visit the Glass Room. It's theglassroomnyc.org. You can visit it online. And it, from the outside, it looks like an Apple showroom. But inside, there's a bunch of products that are relevant to people like our listeners who are interested in privacy. For instance, there is a series of books, large books, featuring every password leaked by, I think it was the LinkedIn hack, 4.7 million passwords in there. You could look up your password. So fitness tracker stuff. There's all sorts of cool things. Who knows your face? There's the data detox bar where you can talk to an ingenious about your devices and data. It's an art project, but it's really about educating people on privacy and data and what's going on. And it's really kind of cool. If I were in New York City, I would definitely want to go. And Baratunde says well worth checking out. The website has a lot of resources on there. TheGlassroomNYC.org. I just wanted to give them a little plug. Is our data as unique as we are? It asks on the front page. Meanwhile, how about a plug for our fine sponsor, Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage was created by the premier mortgage lending company in the United States. Quicken Loans for us. We the people, the geeks, people who don't want to get a loan for a new home or refinance our existing home in the old-fashioned way with boxes of reams of paper and visits to the loan office and all of that. This is a loan, a home loan or a refi you can apply for and get accepted for completely from the comfort of your couch, on your phone, on your tablet, on your computer. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage approval process into the 21st century. It's fast, it's powerful, it's completely online. You can, no paperwork, you can submit your bank statement pay stubs with a touch of a button. You can get approved almost instantly because it's all computerized for a custom mortgage solution tailored to your unique financial situation. And all of this you could do on your phone or tablet. Now, maybe you're saying, well, is it, how well tailored is it? How fast is it? Try it, right? No cost, no obligation to try it. It's a quick online process you can manage from the convenience of your couch. Or, as they show on the website, while you're at an open house and you suddenly get the inspiration, I think we should buy this house. Before you leave, you could show the realtor, we're approved. Find out more at quickenloans.com/securitynow. quickenloans.com/securitynow. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030. Rocket Mortgage, quickenloans.com/securitynow. We thank Rocket Mortgage for their support of our show.
So, a couple goodies. Mail Store 10 was just released and is available. I know that a bunch of our listeners are using probably 9 now. I'm stuck on 8 because 9 doesn't support XP, and 8 just works fine. But for people who want the latest and greatest, I just wanted to point people to the fact that when you use Mail Store, there is a check for updates, but it doesn't do it for you. So just click that. It'll say, oh, look, there's a new one. And you can grab it. And Mail Store 10 Home is free. And it's very much like this Atlas.io toy for email. It's now approaching 3 gigs of email, all indexed and instantly accessible. I really like it. So I don't have to keep it all online. It comes in, indexes it, and then I delete it, and it just stays in this big encrypted store. So very cool. A friend of mine from the news groups shot me a note. His handle in the news groups is Peabody. His first name is George. And he made a really good point. We were talking about Image for Windows. And he said, I want to bring up a point regarding Image for Windows. I use TrueCrypt whole drive encryption on my computers. And since I don't trust the shadow copy process, I use the Image for Linux CD to both create and restore images. The neat thing about Image for Linux is that they put TrueCrypt for Linux on the CD. Actually, now Veracrypt, I guess, he writes. So that means I can boot to the CD, mount the Windows partition in question in TrueCrypt for Linux using the normal pre-boot password, and then Image for Linux can see into the partition in the clear and make the usual smart image with, for example, containing used sectors only, no paging file or hibernation file. Of course, he writes, by default, the image which has then been made is also now in the clear, but you can tell Image for Linux to encrypt it. And he says, and all this also works perfectly during a restore. You mount the partition in TrueCrypt, then restore the image into the mounted partition, and TrueCrypt re-encrypts it on the fly. He says, I've done this several times, and it works. So thank you for the tip, George. I hadn't thought about that, but that's very cool. So the idea being is that they preemptively include TrueCrypt. That is, they meaning Terabyte. Yeah, Terabyte. Yeah.
Okay.
Wow. They preemptively Terabyte Unlimited is their whole name. They're just terabyte.com. They preemptively put TrueCrypt in the image specifically so that you're able to mount whole drive encrypted partitions and or drives and then still be able to intelligently image them. I think that's very cool. It's just not something that had occurred to me before. And without that, of course, it would be imaging pseudo-random noise, and it would just have to make a snapshot, and it couldn't compress it, and it also couldn't own. There would have no way of knowing what was in use and what wasn't, because it would have no access to the file system. So, again, very cool. And while we're on the topic of storage, I got a question that I get from time to time. This is from Scott in Woodland, California, who his subject was SpinRite Guide for New Hard Drives. He says, hey, Steve, I've heard you speak briefly about running SpinRite on brand new drives, but what metrics should we be looking at to determine if the drive is healthy or should be returned? And remember that back in the old days, Compaq, they informed me directly, they used to overpurchase by 20% the number of drives that they required, and they ran SpinRite with a corporate license on every drive. You know, this is Compaq down in Texas, the big original IBM clone, because back then drives had no native intelligence, and so their defects were exposed, flapping in the breeze for everyone to see. And the problem was there were defect charts on the drive, which sometimes SpinRite would confirm some. Often it would find additional, and sometimes it could not find any where the chart said there were. So, and of course, that assumed that the interleave was also correct, which complicated things because the chart normally talked about it identified the defect in bytes from the index mark, where the index is a rotational index that occurs once, obviously, per rotation. And so that gave you a sort of a means of knowing where angularly around the disk the problem would be. Anyway, SpinRite today, as I have mentioned, uses the smart data to publish what the drive is showing. And the confounding thing is that I should just finish saying that what would happen is that Compaq would use SpinRite to sort the drives by apparent quality. That is, they would find the ones that SpinRite found the most defects in and sort them and return 20% out of their overage that they deliberately ordered, keeping the best of the balance to ship out with their machines, which, you know, I thought was a great story and a nice use of SpinRite back then. Today, the problem is that manufacturers' only obligation is to support the API, the so-called ATAPI, ATAPI, AT attachment programming interface. That's essentially the spec for the connector, the electrical interface, and the commands that the computer sends to the controller that's on the drive. So their obligation is simply to receive data and to return the data from their mass storage. They're free to do whatever they want to inside. So as a consequence, all drives differ in their guts, and so what they expose differs. So there's two things, sort of two rules of the road, rules of thumb that you can use. One is if you have, the way Compaq did, multiple of the same make and model drive, you can compare them to each other. There will be one which is worse off than the others. So, frankly, everybody lets you return a drive if you do it quickly. You could buy one or two extra. Run SpinRite on all of them and just look at the smart data after SpinRite's through or along the way. You will see one or two you'll literally be able to rank them in terms of the number of error corrections that were required, the number of seek errors that the drive experienced, and a number of other parameters that SpinRite will show. But the problem is, by itself, one drive, there's no way to know if those numbers are good or bad. The only thing you can do is to compare the same drive, the same make and model, and it really needs to be the same because the technologies drift over time, compare them, and that'll help you find a weak one. If you only do have one drive, there is another trick you can use, and that is that SpinRite uniquely, as far as I know, has never been done before, is tracking the so-called bit error rate, the actual correctable rate at which errors occur, and it aggregates them in 1 megabit bundles. And on that smart screen, it shows you maximum, minimum, and average for example, ECC, the error corrections required. And that is in units of errors per megabit. A drive should probably have none of them are going to be zero. Once upon a time, yes. Now that just doesn't happen. Drives are generating correctable errors all the time by design, and then the error correction circuitry fixes it. But that gives us an incredibly sensitive indicator of the actual quality of the raw pre-corrected data. That is, SpinRite is able to obtain that. So you would like to see not a large difference between the minimum and the maximum rate of errors. That is, as the SpinRite moves across the disk, you would like to see the rate at which the errors are occurring being relatively uniform. If there's a spot where they suddenly spike, SpinRite will retain that as the maximum error rate in that region. That'll push the average up a little bit, but it separately tracks minimum and maximum. So you'd like to see not a huge variation between minimum and maximum. And so that's something you can do just with one single drive. You know, there's just a whole lot, as I have said, a lot of technology under the hood, which I really exposed for the first time in SpinRite 6, was where a lot of this was worked out. Okay, our final miscellany bits. There's a site, Humble Bundle, which itself is a tongue twister, which until Wednesday night, so Wednesday, December 7th, is offering an amazing, not old, but current array of O'Reilly's ebooks in all three electronic forms, as a PDF, as an EPUB, and as Mobi. And so Amazon likes Mobi, iOS likes EPUB, you know, Apple likes EPUB and PDF. Everybody can read that. And you get all formats. You don't have to choose one of. They offer for free. Oh, and I should mention that none of this is expensive. I'll cover that in a second. But you are donating to a charity of your choice.
Some of it goes to O'Reilly. Right. Some of it goes to Humble Bundle. And you can, by the way, right, they have a very unique way of paying for it. You have little sliders that you say how much goes to each. So it's kind of cool.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So for free, and there are two bundles. There are two sets of bundles. One is for O'Reilly Unix/Linux books, and the other is they say science and discovery books. Right. And basically, they are a whole bunch of maker books. So for free, you get, and I guess it's free, 10 Steps to Linux Survival. You pay a dollar or more, which also unlocks this set of five for a dollar or more. Unix in a Nutshell, Sed and Awk, Lex and Yak, Learning the Bash Shell, and the Linux Pocket Guide. You know, I've bought all those.
Yeah, I have three out of the five, but I still bought the bundle.
Yeah, way more than a dollar,
yeah,
too.
Oh, yeah, they're really expensive books.
You move up to $8 or more. You get all of that and the Bash Cookbook, Classic Shell Scripting, Learning GNU Emacs, Unix Power Tools, Learning the VI and Vim Editors, the Bash Pocket Reference, and Learning Unix for OS X. It's just amazing. And $15 or more gets you all of that and Essential System Administration, TCP/IP Network Administration, the classic DNS and Bind book. I'm sure it's behind me on the bookshelf.
That one's thick too, isn't it? That's a thick book.
Yeah. And it's the Bible for DNS and network troubleshooting tools. So I just wanted to make sure all of our listeners knew, because, you know, for $15 and, you know, give them a little more to a favorite charity.
I think I paid $35. I paid whatever the recommended amount was.
Yeah. And look, I mean, it's a treasure trove of ebooks,
yeah,
in PDF, EPUB, and Mobi form. And
by the way, yeah, that's the point. It's not; these are not print books. They're all ebooks. Yeah,
correct.
Yeah, but I thought this was a great deal, and I agree. I thought it was a great kind of way to contribute to charity and get great books for an amazing price. So
yeah,
I jumped right on that. But there's 19 hours left as we record. So
yes, so not a lot of time for the Unix Linux. The Science and Discovery section has, I think, 8 days left on it. It was nine days yesterday.
And they always do more, and they do game bundles and software bundles. This is a very interesting business, this Humble Bundle business.
Yeah, so I was a little put off. Well, I mean, so the Science and Discovery is basically the maker, the make colon,
which is
stuff.
Also O'Reilly. I mean, obviously they have a deal with O'Reilly.
Yeah. And the one that jumped off out at me was make colon fire.
I have that one. It's awesome.
And the subject line or the subtitle was the art and science of working with propane.
Yeah,
and I'm thinking, what could possibly go wrong?
They sent it to me. I love that book. I have it somewhere. It's hysterical. I'm not giving it to my 14-year-old, though. I can tell you that right now.
No. Yeah. And Leo, we have not mentioned the first season finale of Westworld.
I know where you're going with that one.
I'm not going anywhere, except I'm going to watch the entire thing again.
Yes, me too.
I'm going to wait maybe 6 months because, I don't need to watch it right away. But it was like, OMG. And now I need, now that I know, and then be very careful. People who are behind or who have not jumped in, don't let anybody say anything to you because this is one of those that's easy to spoil. Really. Even people, I have some friends that are deep into like following every Reddit theory there is, and they were completely surprised. They were just like, "Whoa, I didn't see that coming." So, anyway, it was great, and I want to watch the entire thing again.
Well, episodes. Once you see the end, you have to kind of say reassess everything you saw in the beginning. And,
Exactly. Yeah. I have a new sci-fi author, and the good news is in print on Kindle, his books are Kindle Unlimited, and of course they are also available on Audible. His name is A.G. Riddle, R-I-D-D-L-E. G is for Jerry, G-E-R-R-Y. And it seems like he's got the same kind of connection that Michael Crichton had, because you may have noticed everything Michael Crichton ever wrote went to a movie. This guy, A.G. Riddle, has two concepts, both optioned and under development for movies. I just last night finished reading the trilogy, which is known as The Origin Mystery. I would call it a thriller, action-adventure, mystery sci-fi novel. It's not a perfect trilogy. I read some of the one and two star comments because I was curious. And I could, these people were a little grumbly, but it's like, yeah, okay, I guess I can see that. I loved them. It's huge and sprawling and kind of breathtaking. And the first one is called The Atlantis Gene, then The Atlantis Plague, and the Atlantis World. And it's sort of historical and genetics and evolution and reimagines the Atlantis mythology. And we got aliens and transporting and all kinds of cool stuff mixed in. So I'll add it to my SF, my sci-fi reading guide as soon as I get a chance, because it was a win. CBS Films is adapting the Atlantis novels for a feature film trilogy. And I put in my notes here, good luck with that. Because if there's ever been a series of books you have to read, I get why they would want to make it a movie, because it's a really interesting concept, but none of the richness of these books could possibly appear on the screen. There's just too much there. I mean, they were long books, but really engaging. So The Atlantis Gene, The Atlantis Plague, and The Atlantis World. And then he has that trilogy. Then, and I should mention that, That debut novel, The Atlantis Gene, his first book, has sold over 2 million copies in the U.S., has been translated into 18 languages, and, as I mentioned, is in development to be a major motion picture. He has another book that I will get to eventually called Departure. And the tease is Flight 305 took off in 2015, but it crashed in a world very different from our own. Now five strangers must unravel why they were taken and how to get home. And 20th Century Fox is adapting that book for a film. HarperCollins acquired it, rights to it for seven figures. It was initially published electronically, and then it went to hardback. And more than a quarter million copies have been sold pre-release. And it's being well reviewed.
This guy's popular.
Yeah, and Leo, it's a different form of writing. I'm not sure how I would describe it. It's sort of a declarative writing style. He doesn't spend a lot of time in infinite character development where it's like, okay, I really don't care what they had for dinner. But I mean, it's really, I mean, because there's so much.
That's right up your alley.
he's covering so much ground. Anyway, I don't think our listeners will be disappointed. And if you are a Kindle Unlimited user or subscriber, as I am, they're free. So what's your excuse? And it's funny, as I was finishing, like I was in the epilogue of the third book of the trilogy, I get a note from Amazon that the next book in the Altrian Enigma series, or the the Roe Agenda Assimilation series.
Yeah.
So remember, Roe Agenda were the three high school kids that found the alien ship behind a cloaked or inside a cloaked cave, and a really great trilogy. A lot of our listeners of this podcast loved it and have commented that how much fun they had. Well, that was the Roe Agenda trilogy. That's followed by and these are written by Richard Phillips. That's followed by the Roe Agenda Assimilation. And the first book of that was called The Kasari Nexus, which I loved. And I just got and I pre-ordered the number two book months ago, just as I'm finishing this third book of the origin mystery, The Atlantis World. I get notice from Amazon that my Kindle has just finished receiving the Altrian Enigma, which is the second. So I was very excited. So I'm going to have to reread, of course, the Kasari Nexus to remember what Jennifer and what's his name were up to when we last left them and everybody else, and then go into the next one. So
his name is Amnesia. That's all my news. I think it's Amnesia. I'm guessing, but I'm not sure. No, I'm kidding. Teasing. Do you want to do we're definitely not going to get questions in at this point. It's going to be the first Q&A episode with no questions.
This is the first Q&A with no Q&A.
I think we need to rename this episode. Do you want to do a spin right before we wrap it up?
I already talked about spin
right. Oh, you did. So I missed it. Okay.
We're all good.
We're all good. We're all good. Yes. Well, what a fun show. And
We will hold the question for next week.
Somebody in the chat room said, can you do a question and answer episode without a question? Well, we just did. If you enjoy this show, there's 588 other ones, and many of them have questions and answers as well. This is the first time they haven't. You'll find those shows at Steve's site, grc.com. That's where you'll also find his bread and butter, SpinRite, the world's finest hard drive recovery and maintenance utility. You'll also find all the free stuff he does, grc.com. And he has audio of the show, but he also has written transcripts, you know, human, well-transcribed transcripts of the show. And I would, if you're going to collect the podcast, collect the transcripts as well, because I think they're greatly valuable. And it also aids search, because Google indexes those transcripts, so it means that the search for stuff within the shows is much easier.
Apparently, we've been making Elaine anxious from these.
Why is that?
Well, look at the content that she's having to transcribe.
Poor woman. I feel sorry. Feel sorry for
her.
She's
like, oh my God.
You'll also find audio and video at our site, twit.tv/SN, and you can even subscribe. You'll find this podcast everywhere you find podcasts. And do subscribe. You don't want to miss an episode. We do the show on Tuesdays at about 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern. That's 21:30 UTC if you want to tune in live and join us in our chat room at irc.twit.tv. But you can, you know, you can get on demand in that. So just make it as convenient as you need it to be. And we'll be back next week. Maybe we'll have some questions then. Who knows?
Yeah, let's hope for some questions. We have questions. Maybe we'll have time to get to them.
Answers would be nice.
Thanks, Leo.
Thanks, Steve. We'll see you next time.
Security now.